Hello, this is Jeff Treisman.
This is Matt Schmidt.
And you're listening to In Politic.
I ask you to consider, how do we focus our message? And how do we communicate our message so that it is as crisp and as clear as the mountains of Austria? If we all work together and if we communicate together, that wall will come down, I promise you. And the polar bears will be dancing on those icebergs and life will be good. We can terminate pollution. Let's get our message together and let's work together. We need the people to put the pressure on our elected leaders, on our politicians, to change the status quo and to achieve sweeping change. Because the elected leaders, let me tell you, what I've seen all over the world, they're frozen. Some politicians have told me they don't really want to do any environmental changes because they don't think the people are quite ready. But we all know that's a bunch of horse shit, isn't it?
In today's episode, we actually feature two guests. Dr. Jeffrey Henderson is a visiting assistant professor in environmental studies at Colby College. His research focuses on the question of how to make democracy work better in the context of large-scale environmental problems, particularly climate change. Also joining us is Dr. Patrick Honeycutt, assistant professor of environmental science and policy in Chapman University's Environmental Science and Policy Program. He studies how communities organize themselves to make environmental decisions and how different forms of environmental policy affect a community's well-being. With that, gentlemen, welcome to In Politic.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Our conversation today is going to be about air pollution, right? And how that affects political participation, which has obviously been the focus of your research. But before we get into any of the findings, I think it would be helpful for audience members to first understand key terms, which I anticipate that you'll likely use in the conversation today. So could you kindly define, one, political participation, and then two, explain how you define air pollution in the most basic layman terms?
Absolutely. So I'd be happy to start with political participation. So essentially, participation in politics is anything, any kind of activity that someone engages in that has some political meaning to it. So whether that's going to the polls, or whether it's knocking on doors to get out the vote, participating in a community meeting to advocate on an issue before, let's say, an elected representative, calling a member of Congress, any of these things qualify as political participation. So it's really any way that someone takes time out of their day to be involved in either elections or pushing for some kind of policy change.
And so if I jump in here to set that up, the way you measure political participation is that most of the activities you're describing are counted in some way, right?
Yeah. So we're working with an organization that essentially tracks political participation among its participants. So this is an organization that advocates for policy change in areas like climate policy. And what they essentially do is they have sign-up forms online. When someone fills out that form, it indicates that they want to participate in the activity. And so we're actually able to track, how often are people signing up to, for instance, go door-to-door and canvass to get out the vote? How often are they signing up for some kind of demonstration? Or how often are they attending a meeting? Things of that nature.
Yeah, and then I can take a crack at air pollution. So to zoom out super far, right? The Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S. is mandated to regulate the production of a bunch of different types of air pollutants. These are called criteria air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, right, adopted in 1970. And of those air pollutants, in this paper, we focus on particulate matter pollution, or PM2.5 for short. We're talking about PM2.5. We're really talking about microscopic, really fine inhalable particles that are about 2.5 micrometers or smaller in their diameter. So to give you a sense of scale, that's about 30 times smaller in terms of diameter than like a strand of human hair. And PM2.5 is produced in a number of ways. It can be emitted directly into the atmosphere from things like smokestacks, right? When we burn coal, the soot that is created from that coal kind of enters into the atmosphere as PM2.5. It can be blown off of construction sites, right? If there's open mounds of dirt, we can have particles in there that fit the definition that become air pollution. And then probably the biggest and most obvious source of air pollution, at least here in the American West of the last, 10 years has been wildfires, right? So when there's wildfires, a tremendous amount of PM2.5 enters into the atmosphere. That's not the only way that PM2.5 can, end up in our air. I mean, it also has a number of secondary sources, meaning that PM2.5 can actually form as a result of chemical reactions between other types of air pollutants that are emitted from power plants, from industrial activities, from tailpipes, things of that nature. So in this paper, we're really focusing on PM2.5 in part because it is this kind of ubiquitous air pollutant.
So, and just to finish this out, right, this is bad. How is this bad? Yeah. Gives us cancer or what?
Yeah. So remember I said the EPA is required to regulate air PM2.5 under the Clean Air Act. That is because we know PM2.5 is a massive threat to public health and public well-being more generally. So some estimates suggest that globally, air pollution causes about 1 in 9 deaths. In the US, outdoor particulate matter pollution remains like the fifth highest mortality risk. In 2015, it was estimated to cause about 89,000 deaths. That's because when you inhale PM2.5, it negatively impacts both your respiratory system, so your lungs, and your cardiovascular health, your heart. It's not just physical health, though. We have increasing evidence showing that higher levels of air pollution are associated with more mental health problems as well. There's a recent paper that came out showing how air pollution reductions actually can reduce suicide risk, right? And of course, those health impacts are going to aggregate up into broader economic impacts that undermine people's well-being. So in 2014 alone, air pollution costs the US about 5% of its GDP. We know that, for example, if there are farm workers outside breathing in a lot of air pollution, those workers are less productive. It's not just outdoor workers, too. There's some research suggesting that breathing in PM2.5 can undermine the productivity of like office workers as well. Right. So PM2.5 is regulated by the EPA really because of those impacts on people's health and their ability to, sustain an income.
So. Yeah, in even in terms of national security, for us, I usually talk to my students about, okay, your future career, the essence of national security is protect human life. Where should the emphasis lie? Should it be in building tanks and armaments and guns and stuff like that? Or should we look at elsewhere to protect human life? And then I talk about that article that was published in The Lancet in 2017, I think it was, a bunch of medical doctors collectively around the world. It made international headlines, I guess, this piece. What is the leading cause of death in the world today? And they found, hands down, without a doubt, the leading cause of death in the world globally is pollution. And that includes all types of pollution, air, water, soil, et cetera. But what was interesting is their estimates is shocking. A certain number of millions of people die per year, whatever it is, by pollution. And of course, they said, the numbers are probably much higher than what we could actually establish because we couldn't, in many cases, prove a direct correlation between an individual's death and pollution. And then when you move down that list, it's like smoking, it's diseases, think COVID-19, right? Car accidents and road accidents. And then you get to war and murder. And so I use that to challenge my students or policymakers writ large, what should we be doing if our job is to protect our electorates, our citizens and human beings around the world? But we'll get into the so what of that correlation between pollution and political participation in the second, but kind of building on this before we kind of get into nitty gritty, I'm always curious, what actually motivated you to write this paper or like do this study? It's, you think about these correlations that exist and so random. How did you guys stumble on this topic?
So Jeff and I are environmental politics scholars, right? Meaning that we're deeply committed to understanding how political things and environmental phenomena kind of relate to each other. And I don't know, I think one narrative that I was taught in a lot of the environmental policy classes that I took, you know, as a high school student and as an undergrad, was that, like, you know, the US has solved air pollution. Air pollution has been this thing that people have mobilized against, and we've created policies that really have curbed air pollution. And that is true. Like, things like the Clean Air Act have really made tremendous reductions in the amount of aggregate air pollution here in the United States. But I think when you start to look at, say, disparities in exposure to air pollution, and you think about the political story through which air pollution is produced, you start to see how these two things are actually related to one another in particular ways. So on the one hand, you know, Jeff and I, as, you know, environmental politics scholars who are, you know, just nerds about the history of environmentalism in the US, you know, we see things like the Earth Day movement emerge, the environmental justice movement sustain itself really from like the late 19th century onward, in part as a response to high levels of industrial pollution and air pollution, right? So that kind of keys us into this idea that, you know, maybe in the aggregate, when air pollution worsens, we will see people collectively mobilize in response to it, right? Demand policy change through, you know, conventional channels, like, as Jeff was saying, voting, or what we look at more in this paper here, like non-conventional channels, right? People protesting, you know, participating in a social movement. The weird thing is, there are also examples, you know, throughout US history of places experiencing tremendously high levels of air pollution, but there being no political mobilization in response to that. And you know, here I'm thinking of like the American steel town, Gary, Indiana, right? Where, unlike other cities in the Midwest, really high levels of air pollution weren't followed immediately with political action to reduce that. So I think that empirical puzzle, right, that puzzling variation in air pollution kind of drove us in a broad way to try to adopt some research design that allowed us, you know, to adjudicate between those two different stories.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, you know, for me, I kind of backed into the study of air pollution from studying climate change and collective efforts to address it. So, you know, if we back up about 10 years, I'm just out of college. My first job is working in a think tank on Capitol Hill trying to advocate climate policy. And very quickly, I ran into the recognition that it wasn't that we didn't have the technology, wasn't that we didn't have the ideas. It was that there wasn't a strong enough political movement pushing for the shift away from fossil fuels, which, as it turns out, wouldn't just address climate change, but it would also address air pollution. And so that started to get me thinking about the role that communities coming together and participating in politics, not just as individuals, but as part of a team, you know, in ways that sent powerful messages to policymakers that, you know, change was sort of an imperative if they wanted to keep their elected position. You know, one good example of this is the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. So they actually have this incredible map of coal plants across the country that were either existing and retired early or proposed and defeated by communities pushing back against them. And this really helped start kind of the trend of kind of the shift away from coal and toward natural gas, which, while it is a climate pollutant, right, it does generate methane, it is less harmful for sort of local air quality. So, you know, starting to think about these communities working together and shift policy started to lead me to the question of, well, are there barriers to this kind of collective mobilization that is helping public health? And, you know, that's where Patrick and I sort of started to put our heads together and look for what are some systematic things we can identify across the country that are keeping these movements for change from realizing their full potential.
It's really fascinating what you're saying about community movements and organization. Can you talk briefly about how, you know, the anti-coal movement or other movements have framed their activities? Are they framing it in terms of public health? Are they framing it in terms of climate?
Yeah, so I think we see a number of different frames kind of depending on the context, but public health seems to be the strongest one. So, there are communities in this country that have, you know, had coal plants for many, many years now, and the health impacts have been really evident, right? You know, you have elevated levels of a whole variety of respiratory illnesses, from asthma to, in some cases, lung cancer. You know, the World Health Organization is sort of in the last few years kind of saying that, you know, there's sort of a similar level of health risk to smoking cigarettes from just living in proximity to some of these pollutants, right? And so, you know, while climate change and while a whole host of other local factors are sometimes cited as reasons to transition away from coal, you know, really the public health impacts are in many ways the most tangible. And, you know, I think this sort of has allowed communities to come together, you know, because basically everyone is seeing these health impacts, right? You have examples, like, for instance, communities where there's neighborhood oil drilling in Los Angeles, where, you know, if someone goes around and talks to everyone, they all have stories of sort of this weird dust that's landing on their cars and they can't really explain it. The plants randomly die off and they can't explain it. And
is this like La Brea? Has it been there? And
oh,
no, those are, no, probably not.
I don't know how close it is to La Brea, but yeah, I mean, there are a number of communities in Los Angeles and other cities where, you know, neighborhood oil drilling is sort of directly exposing the community residents to much higher levels of atmospheric air pollution than are healthy. And so when advocates go through the community and talk to folks, everyone has these same stories, and it can be a really powerful unifier, kind of leading the community to push for policy change that can protect them from these threats.
And if I could just push that even further in terms of, you know, additional frames, as I kind of alluded to earlier, one thing that's become very clear from the research in the last 10 years is that predominantly Black communities, predominantly low-income communities, communities of color, immigrant communities face much higher levels of air pollution than do predominantly high-income, predominantly white communities as well. And that is, you know, not really a function of individual prejudice as much as it is a function of how the US's environmental policy framework has not guaranteed kind of equal treatment for different social groups. So you will often also see communities mobilizing against environmental problems under that frame of, you know, producing environmental justice as well too. And that certainly is the case. You know, Jeff is kind of talking about communities in South LA that are exposed to increased levels of not just air pollution, but, you know, water pollution due to neighborhood drilling operations that can be, you know, linked back to redlining, for example. Right. So that's another compelling frame that we see when communities are mobilizing against these problems.
Can you explain real quick for the audience what redlining is? And if you have a sense of, you guys are talking about, you know, this being a neighborhood oil drilling, right? Which sort of boggles the mind when you think about this. But how many people, how many Americans are really in this proximity of danger to what you're talking about, and what's redlining?
Yeah. So I can't answer that second question with a tremendous amount of precision. I mean, I will say, so I grew up on the, you know, so I'll just speak from my own experience. I grew up on the East Coast in Virginia. And then when I moved out to Southern California in particular, it became very shocking to me how close in proximity people live to industrial operations, right? And I think when you drive through the LA area, you see oil drills right in the middle of neighborhoods. So I don't know what the exact number is, but it is still, like, as someone who is not from places like LA, it's shocking to kind of be in that and realize that people are living in really close proximity to these.
Yeah, and that big Miller High Life plant on off the 210, right?
Yeah, I drive by it frequently. Yeah, it's. I mean, Jeff and I have had. I've called him probably like once a week for the last 2 years. Like, what is going on? Anyway. Yeah. So redlining. What is redlining? So redlining is it's referring to an explicitly racist economic policy that the federal government launched during the Great Depression to effectively hand out loans for prospective home buyers. And what we learn, if we look back at the documents used to evaluate neighborhoods for worthiness for those loans, we find that federal evaluators systematically assigned like higher credit ratings, like safer borrower ratings to predominantly white, predominantly American, and predominantly high income neighborhoods relative to neighborhoods of color, neighborhoods where there are majority of immigrants. And we tend to call that practice redlining because if you look at the maps that the government produced kind of visualizing loan worthiness, the areas with the worst credit ratings were kind of filled in red. And there's research showing that historic redlining is associated with higher levels of pollution today, with closer proximity to fossil fuel infrastructure today, and with other kind of environmental outcomes like, you know, less green space within cities, lower biodiversity, less participation in biodiversity monitoring too. You can think of the mechanism there as like, well, if you're excluded from a policy that allows you to own land, then all of a sudden you lose a lot of agency about how that land is going to be developed and used. And you also don't face as strong as an incentive to like sell that land and move elsewhere, right? So the built environment then changes around you in ways that lead to these kind of contemporary environmental problems.
Yeah, so kind of linking this back to the concept of environmental justice is, oftentimes sort of broken down into several components. The first is whether communities are evenly distributed, whether the benefits and harms of basically energy use or in general kind of environmental benefits and harms, are those evenly distributed across communities? Or is there a systematic relationship between those harms or benefits and say race or class, or perhaps the intersection of the two? So that's sort of the first level of environmental justice. Are communities essentially getting equal or equitable outcomes? The next level of environmental justice is, well, you know, we can think about why some communities get better outcomes than others in terms of how much they're represented in politics. How much of a voice do they have? Do they get a seat at the table when decisions are made? That's sort of the deeper level down, right? As communities lose their agency, right, if decisions are being made at a political level that doesn't incorporate their needs, their priorities, their sort of vision for what their community should be, they're more likely to end up with these really polluting projects that end up really affecting public health.
Let me try to bring this back around to the focus of the research that you've done now. And the most simple one sentence explanation for audience members that totally new to them, myself included, you have found essentially that air pollution negatively impacts political participation in the most basic sense. Let me try to challenge you further, and we try to always do this with guests on the podcast, is imagine we were sitting down for a Thanksgiving dinner right now, and your crazy uncle or aunt or whoever want to know, oh, tell me about your research. How would you explain it to somebody at Thanksgiving dinner this year, what your paper and your research studies and what it finds?
So I would say, you know, what Jeff and I did is we went out and we measured how much air pollution was occurring at an average rate at the county level across the United States. And we went out and we also measured basically how many people were mobilizing to participate in a social movement in those same counties. And then what we tried to do is just see, like, how do these things statistically relate to each other, right? After we try to account for all of the other things in the world that we know affect both the production of air pollution and whether or not people mobilize for politics, like folks' income, for example. And what we find is that levels of participation in this social movement are lower in places that experience higher levels of air pollution relative to places that experience lower levels of air pollution. And we think, because of the way that we've designed the research, that that suggests there is this possible negative relationship between being exposed to air pollution and then choosing to kind of not participate in a social movement. That is not a finding. Like, I think Jeff and I entering into this project, like, that was probably not totally, like, consistent with our expectations, kind of given our knowledge of environmental politics in the U.S. But
so explain that. Why was that not consistent? What was your age zero right on there?
Yeah.
I can take this one. So basically, the expectation that we had, based on a whole bunch of history, is that when people are breathing polluted air, they're not happy about it. You know, when it's having health effects on your community and you're seeing either yourself or your friends and family, you know, getting sick, oftentimes throughout history, that's led to a, you know, mass mobilization against it. I mean, we saw this in the US, we saw it in Japan, we saw it in the UK and so forth.
All these cases, yeah.
So, you know, the prior that we had was basically that the more polluted the place, the higher the level of organized opposition there would be. So what we're looking at here is how many people are participating in movements that are pushing against fossil fuels, against the policies that are keeping these communities polluted. And so the reason why we were surprised is that we actually saw the causal arrow go in the other direction. And we think that the health impacts might be explaining that.
I didn't think about that, what the assumption would be. I mean, that was part of my question of, you know, what motivated the research. But now that you explain that, I mean, I think back, like, 19th century, people are mobilizing for better work conditions and you're tired of breathing in or working in mines or whatever the case may be. So that's interesting. I honestly didn't think about that you would assume there'd be higher levels of political mobilization and participation. Now, there are other factors, obviously, at play, right? I also, as anybody who knows politics in general, you would assume that, you know, income, lower levels of income or race or education or employment types, again, thinking about like blue collar jobs or factory workers, those would all have a much greater impact in levels of political participation. That's something you took into account in your research. Can you explain that again in layman's terms, you know, how you consider that and what has the greater impact? I mean, is it education? Is it income? Is it pollution? Or do all these things matter?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jeff, you should answer that second question in more detail. But my response is that it's like pretty much everything matters, right? Political participation is an outcome with many, many causes. And depending on what moment in history you're looking at it, who you're studying, right, the strength of those causes is going to vary. But I certainly believe that why people decide to go out and protest is not a function of any one variable exclusively. So like in our research, how do we account for all of these other factors? Is that the question? Okay. To explain it simply. So our biggest challenge here is that the level of pollution in a particular place is likely driven by a bunch of factors that also determine whether or not people engage in politics, right? For example, a place might be very, very polluted because the oil and gas industry there has a lot of political power. If the oil and gas industry there has a lot of political power, it might employ a lot of people, which then might make those people less likely to turn out in politics. And in that case, the lower level of turnout is going to be a function of that industry not necessarily air pollution, right? So that's the kind of challenge we need to address in this paper. And effectively, we do that with a statistical technique that allows us to isolate levels of air pollution that are explained by things other than those political factors. So I want you to imagine that in a particular place, there's like 100 units of PM2.5. It's 100 particles. It's likely the case that 80 of those particles are in the atmosphere due to things that also explain why people turn out or don't for politics. But the remaining 20 of those particles are there because of weather, because of meteorological conditions, because the place is not very windy at all. So when air pollution is emitted, it tends to stay there, or because there's a temperature inversion in the atmosphere that's preventing the air or the air from rising and from pollution from dispersing. So in essence, what the statistical technique does is it allows us to throw away those 80 units of air pollution that are explained by political factors and retain the remaining units of air pollution that are due to weather, and then use those units to try to understand whether or not social movement participation is increasing or decreasing. It's not a perfect technique by any means, but we do a lot of work in the paper to try to support its use.
So the bottom line is, in the sense that air pollution itself reinforces, right, air pollution, because air pollution reinforces political apathy.
Yeah, I think that's what the case that Jeff and I try to make in the paper, right? So we say, look, air pollution remains a serious problem in places like the US, despite all this regulation, because in part it is produced by these like structural problems, right? It is produced by, you know, an economic system that allows pollution levels to persist at unsafe levels, right? If we want to change those, if we want to address those more structural problems, then we need social movements for all the reasons that we've talked about, right? Because they allow the public to have their voices be more strongly represented in the policymaking process. And in this paper, what we find is that the environmental problem that these social movements can mobilize against actually constrains their ability to do that. So then if you think about this like broader causal story, what it suggests is that if pollution persists, it might undermine, you know, the political mobilization that we need to address it, such that in the future, we will experience higher levels of pollution, right? That there's this like negative feedback loop between pollution, you know, the policies that we use to regulate it, and then the social forces that lobby for or against those policies.
Yeah.
I'm completely depressed now. Thank you very much for that.
I know. I hate you. It's hard to talk about this paper.
I'll do my best to lift your spirits, Matt.
Please.
So there's research that asks the question of why do people get active in politics or in social movements? And there was a really influential book in the 1990s, which has still provided a lot of the basis for our thinking about this. And it presented kind of three explanations for why people don't participate. So one is that they can't. Either they don't have the money. So, you know, if you don't have the money, you can't cut a check to a politician. You might not have the time. So you might not be able to, you know, go knock doors to get out the vote. You might not be able to attend a protest. Or you might not have the skills, or you might not perceive yourself to have them, right? So if you don't think you know enough about politics, could you participate in a lobby day, right? I mean, some people do anyway, right? But, you know, you need to evaluate that for yourself. So that's kind of one dimension of it, right? Is can you participate? Do you think you have the necessary time, money, and skills? The second question is, do you actually want to participate, right? Some people don't participate because they don't want to. They are, you know, skeptical that any of their participation could matter, even if they did have the skills and the time and the money, because they don't believe that the political system's responsive to them. They might not also want to because they're just tired. You know, they're just not feeling well. And, you know, you only have so much free time after work. So that's kind of the motivation piece. How interested are you in politics? How efficacious do you think your action will be? The third dimension, the third reason why people don't participate is because nobody asked. So it turns out that a lot of the participation in politics is actually explained by just being asked by a friend or a family member. It's really remarkable. Like, you know, if you have, you know, a bunch of canvassers knocking on doors in a community, oftentimes you can increase voter turnout by a few percentage points. Just being asked to get involved in politics actually makes a huge difference because people feel like, oh, like maybe my participation is valued. And similarly within a social movement, right? You know, if I say to my friend, you know, we need someone to carry the banner at the march. We need someone who, you know, has gone to the gym enough that they can carry this banner for several hours. Can you do that? You know, that makes a person feel valued. And so they're more likely to participate. So, you know, all of these factors are kind of, helping to explain why someone does or does not engage in everything from voting to advocating for different policies. And what we're kind of arguing here is that air pollution actually decreases all of those three levers that make it more likely that someone participates. And I'd be happy to unpack that a little bit more.
Please keep going. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So the first reason people don't participate sometimes is that they can't. They don't have the time or the money or the skills. So think about if someone is feeling really sick, if someone is struggling with the sort of health consequences of air pollution, whether they're consciously aware of that or not, right, they're going to have less energy. They're going to have less free time that they're going to be able to devote to, you know, really intense political organizing, right? Attending meetings or attending marches or rallies or those kinds of things, right? If someone's not feeling well, they're more likely to stay home. I mean, all of us as professors, you know, we know this to be true. So that's one dimension of it. The second dimension is interest or efficacy, right? You know, if someone doesn't believe that things are ever going to change, they're less likely to participate in that change. And so, you know, this goes back to the example of Gary, Indiana that Patrick gave, right? Air pollution at the time, you know, in the late 20th century, mid to late 20th century, was essentially a non-issue there. And the reason was it was a company town dominated by the steel industry. And it was just kind of understood that, you know, the elected officials were going to be responsive to the steel industry and they weren't going to put additional regulations on their production. So that's the second component. The third component is where it starts to get out of the realm of just the individual's choices, and it starts to get into network effects, community effects. So if someone is less likely to participate if no one asked, what if the people doing the asking are also themselves less active, right? So let's say that there are a few members of the community that are really influential. Let's say that there are several volunteers who are leaders within a local movement, for climate action or for environmental protection. Let's say that those people feel burnt out. They don't feel that they have the energy to invest in mobilizing people. Well, that means that a whole bunch of other people aren't going to get asked to participate and therefore are less likely to participate themselves.
So, first, was this Bob Putnam's work?
So Putnam's work was really influential in showing that a whole bunch of civic organizations, right, everything from the Elks Club to bowling leagues, were in decline. And Putnam drew a link between the decline in those civic organizations and people's participation. Because as people became sort of less and less connected to the networks where they were more likely to be asked to participate, they A, were less likely to be asked, and B, were less likely to feel that sense of civic involvement that sort of motivated them to believe that change was possible.
Wait, no. I have to interrupt. So Jeff, you said you were going to buoy my spirits. Where are my spirits being buoyed in this? It sounds like this is the, you know, if we're going back to Putnam, this is an impossible scenario to break here. Give me some hope, man.
All right. Well, here's the hope. So there's a whole bunch of studies that suggest that if you knock on someone's door, they're more likely to vote. That's such an easy thing to do, right? You know, if we're worried about democracy, if we're worried about participation in civic life, you know, people just need to be asked. And I think in this world where social media is so prevalent, you know, people are so divided, it's actually kind of rare that someone will have a conversation with a stranger on their doorstep about politics or about policy changes that could help the whole community. And so I think the hopeful note that I'm trying to sound here, and this is, you know, something that community organizations across the country are investing in, is that if you just go door to door and you talk to people, you can start to bridge divides. You can start to sort of bring people into the conversation where before they felt they weren't being listened to. And so you can very quickly start to have a pretty, you know, dramatic impact on people's participation and their sense that their voice matters.
But are you also saying, you said even, well, let me ask though, is that even possible now? Like, you know, Matt's being optimistic here now all of a sudden, but let me bring him down a notch. I mean, nobody knocks on the doors anymore. Nobody wants to. I mean, and how a society has kind of evolved now. I mean, is that even a possible revival solution? Like, yeah, let's just knock on the door.
Well, let me throw in too, though. But the way I understand what you're saying is your research is showing that the presence of air pollution is making the prevalence of door knocking less. So if door knocking is your solution, how do I get over that?
It's a great question. Yeah. So essentially what we're showing is a correlation, right? We're showing that, you know, basically higher levels of air pollution tend to make places less healthy, tend to demobilize networks. But you could also think about enacting a policy that significantly reduces air pollution as significantly lifting, you know, that effect, right? So just as we have a vicious cycle where pollution might beget pollution, we can also have virtuous cycles. And we have the policy tools, we have the technologies, we know how to regulate air pollutants. And so, you know, a policy change that increased regulation or ensured that, you know, the federal government's mandate to protect all communities from pollution, not just the wealthiest ones, could actually make a really big difference in the health of the communities and therefore the ability of the community to come together and push for greater gains in environmental protection and public health. So just as we're currently seeing the vicious cycle, right, the policy changes that we already know work can create a virtuous one.
But the virtuous cycle presumably is heavily connected to political mobilization, right? So if you don't get the political mobilization, you're going to struggle to get the policy change that improves the air pollution, that improves the political mobilization.
Yeah, I mean, I this is something that I think Jeff and I have like gone back and forth on. I mean, for me, particularly as a more like interdisciplinary scholar, so like not just trained in the field of political science, like I think what this paper says is that there, or what it supports are, you know, these very urgent calls to reduce air pollution, potentially by pairing air pollution reductions with like new climate policies, for example. So I think that there are probably behavioral interventions, like that is things that social movements can do in the way that they operate that would reduce or mitigate this particular correlation we show in our paper. Those are things that Jeff's talking about. The same organization that we work with to analyze the data in this project, we're working with them on another project to test some new strategies for bringing people into the movement, for expanding kind of participation in this particular political moment, right, which is quite challenging. So I agree that there are things social movements can do, but I think it's like the broader structural change is what can break that vicious cycle. But to your point, it's a challenging finding, right? Because it suggests that, you know, social movements' ability to do that is not given, right? But instead, it's, you know, reflective of the particular circumstances in which they're operating.
Yeah, and if I can just add one other kind of background characteristic to this, it's that the coal industry is rapidly declining.
Yeah, that's the other thing too.
So as we shift away from coal toward natural gas or renewable energy, right, all of which have declined significantly in price, especially wind and solar power in recent years, we're seeing less sort of use of coal to get our electricity. And as a result, communities are breathing cleaner air. So this is a market trend that's happening in the background. And it's being driven by, you know, both the emergence of new industries and the policies that have fostered those. And so as the air becomes cleaner, you know, if our findings, you know, can be sort of taken to the next logical step, right, that should lead to healthier communities, which in turn should lead to healthier levels of participation and collective action.
So one of the questions I always ask guests on this podcast is fairly simple. Are you optimistic or pessimistic then about the future?
Oh, such a great question.
Can I start with this, Patrick?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
So my view is that hope is a discipline. If you are pessimistic, that is actually a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You know, if you don't believe, as I was saying, right, if you don't believe that your participation in collective action to bring about change will matter, you won't do it. And then that change won't happen. So, you know, I think, you know, many, many folks have put this very eloquently. You know, hope isn't necessarily a well that you draw from. It's not necessarily like a stock that you have. You know, you can bring hope out of your basement. Hope is something that you do. And it's not also something that you have as an individual. It's something that emerges through collective action, right? As you start working with other people, you see that you have much more power when you do that. And so, you know, going back to kind of more concrete things, first of all, we passed a really historic clean energy bill 2 years ago, the Inflation Reduction Act, right? $370 billion worth of investment in tax credits for clean energy. And that's not just for the deployment of clean energy. It's also manufacturing of clean energy here in the US. So really building a viable industry that's going to allow us to shift away from polluting fossil fuels in a big way. Now, was that policy perfect? Did it fully address concerns about environmental justice? Did it go far enough in reducing pollution? Perhaps not. In my view, it could have gone much further. But I think that virtuous cycle has to start somewhere, right? You know, movements for change rarely achieve everything they're going for all in one fell swoop. And that was a pretty dramatic first step in the direction of promoting not just wind and solar power, but also promoting things that'll make us healthier within our own homes, like shifting away from gas furnaces toward heat pumps that rely on electricity and therefore allow us to breathe cleaner air. So I'm very optimistic because not only did we see a really powerful movement for change, right? The young people who mobilized through the Sunrise Movement starting in 2018 to, you know, older generations, you know, working in alliance with them. You know, these movements really helped make the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, and other sort of pro-environmental legislation possible. And now that we have that legislation, I think it really does give people a sense of hope that major federal policy can really change on this issue in really positive ways.
I mean, I think I share in Jeff's optimism, though maybe for slightly different reasons. I mean, the first is, you know, historically, we observe the opposite of the effect that we find in this particular paper, which means that it is possible, obviously, to break out of this cycle that we talk about in the short term. I suspect that if someone were to replicate this study with data either from 10 years in the future or 40 years in the past, they could very well find a very different result because the background conditions kind of characterizing political participation would have changed. So I think what we find in here is like a story that is unique to this particular moment in which like aggregate levels of social movement participation are lower than they have been historically, and people's sense of efficacy, their ability to really shape political outcomes is like historically low. But for all the reasons that Jeff talked about, I think there is optimism to believe that those background conditions would change in a way that you would get a different story between air pollution and social movement participation. And more concrete evidence of that is, you know, I teach an introduction to environmental policy class as part of like the core classes that I teach here. I've taught versions of that class before at UCSB. And one thing that I've noticed, you know, over, I guess, like 6 years of teaching that course now, is that students increasingly are very precisely aware of the relationship between political forces and environmental problems. I think when I was in college, it was more common to believe that environmental problems, these were things that required technological solutions that were driven by economic forces. What I think research has shown quite clearly over the last 10 years is that while those things are important, like politics is particularly impactful on the types of environmental protections that we get and our ability to solve environmental problems. And my students today are now just more naturally informed about that than they were 6 years ago. And I think that one, you know, to Jeff's earlier point about things that can deter people from participating in politics, one of those is acknowledging that there is a problem that political action can help resolve. And I'm optimistic about this generation's belief of that link, right?
I'm buoyed by the optimism, if skeptical. And what I want to know is, do you think that your results about air pollution are likely to hold up about other questions in climate change so that we can share the optimism that you share about those things?
Great question. I think air pollution is a particularly difficult environmental problem. So there is other research on basically with the question of when folks experience some environmental problem related to climate change, do they express stronger beliefs about climate change? Are they more likely to vote for climate friendly policies? Are they more likely to, you know, sign up for an organization that's lobbying against climate change? And the answer to those questions are most of the time, yes, right? There's research showing that at least among Democrat voters, experiencing wildfires leads you to express stronger beliefs about the environment and vote for environmental policies. It's research showing that when you report being exposed to some climate-related disasters like a hurricane, you adopt more pro-climate beliefs, right? So there is research on these different types of environmental problems that shows there is this more like responsive and productive relationship. I think what makes air pollution so difficult, well, I have a scholarly answer to that, and then I have like Patrick's answer to that. So the scholarly answer is that, you know, you can't see air pollution really. And even, you know, here in Southern California, when there are days where I'm like, oh my God, the air pollution outside is wild, it's super hazy, it is so much less hazy relative to what it was in the 1960s that there's, I think, not this kind of like visceral response to air pollution, right? It's not something that, at least most of the time, unless you're experiencing a wildfire, you are clearly linking to some policy failure. And that's either because you're just breathing in the air and you can't see the particles, or it's because, well, you're like, well, in the 60s and the 70s, levels of air pollution were much, much higher than they were now. Things are better than they once were. So I think that there is something particular about air pollution that explains the result. I think part of what builds into that, again, is I think one thing that sometimes gets taught in environmental policy classes is that air pollution is an environmental problem that the U.S. has really solved, like deeply solved. And while I am am very happy to recognize that levels of air pollution in the US have declined massively since the 60s and the 70s as a result of the Clean Air Act. There still are significant both disparities in different groups' exposure to air pollution, and there's just local variation in air pollution exposure that leads places like Orange County and Los Angeles to register like very high and unsafe levels of air pollution. So I think part of it is there are differences between environmental problems that might make some of them more likely to mobilize people while others more likely to demobilize people. But then there's also this like cultural story that we tell ourselves about air pollution as something that doesn't necessarily require more policy action.
I think that's absolutely fascinating to look at the role of narrative in political mobilization. That's great. I call it the Mount Baldy thesis here, right? So like, because you can see Mount Baldy, exactly. You're like, oh, it's okay. Right.
Yeah. And whereas, you know, I have a colleague here who's German, and we were drinking beers one night, and he looked at me, and he's like, Patrick, the air here. And I looked at him, I was like, fine, I know it's crazy how polluted it can be sometimes. And I think that that's because if you don't, you know, if you grew up in LA, it has gotten better. Yeah. Right. And, you know, those experiences are real and they shape how people behave.
Yeah. And Matt, to tie this back into your question about how it relates to climate change, you know, for many years, folks were actually saying, you know, communicators who were running message testing sort of experiments would actually say, you know, if you want to shift away from fossil fuels, it's actually better to message on air pollution than climate change, because air pollution is locally felt and climate change is a global issue. So that was sort of the received wisdom for, you know, several years as climate change was struggling to break through in the political conversation. However, some recent advances in climate science have helped make the problem more tangible to people. So the first is the idea of a carbon budget. So you can say that, like, you know, if we want a stable climate over the course of the next several decades, we need to cut pollution by this much. And therefore, that means that countries like the US can only emit X number of tons of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. So that makes it sort of very real for people. You know, you can say we have X number of years to address this problem. So it creates sort of an urgency. The other thing that we have now is very reliable peer-reviewed scientific research that can actually show the degree to which a single extreme weather event has been exacerbated by climate change since the Industrial Revolution, right? So you can say that such and such a hurricane was X times more powerful, or, you know, Y percent more likely because of the greenhouse gases that humans have put in the atmosphere over the last century and a half. And so that helps make it concrete for people. And I think as people are experiencing more and more kind of weird weather events, whether it's, you know, just things like droughts in California or heat waves, or whether it's the more, you know, kind of sudden weather events like a hurricane, as people are experiencing more and more of these things, you know, another example is the wildfire smoke that affected the Northeast, kind of an unprecedented experience that a lot of folks in the Northeast corridor had, you know, last year. You know, that really leads people to start to make this connection. Now, political discourse has intervened, of course. There are folks who are still, you know, trying to question the science, despite the fact that the science is quite settled. But in general, as people are connecting the dots, you know, between what they're experiencing in their lives and what the science is telling us, I think people are really starting to see climate change happen in their communities. They're starting to see how it changes. You know, I teach a class on envisioning a more just and climate resilient future. Every single one of my students has a story about how their hometown has been affected. Maybe they live in a ski town in Colorado that doesn't get snow as much anymore, right? Or maybe they live in a coastal town in the Northeast that has rising sea levels and is facing increasing amounts of storms that are, you know, affecting people and businesses in their communities, right? Every one of my students can see how just over the course of their childhood, their local communities changed. And so I think awareness is growing in ways that, you know, are really going to enable a level of collective participation on this that could be really impactful.
All right. So I guess final question. If you had a hypothetical megaphone, and as academics, this is very rare for us, right, to be able to reach to whomever you envision, be it a political leader, politicians, citizens who are trying to mobilize, what advice or what would you say to them given your research?
Great question.
I'd be happy to start with this.
Yeah, go Jeff.
So I think one thing that we did with the Inflation Reduction Act is we incentivized the things that we want more of, right? We incentivized wind power, solar power, heat pumps, induction stoves and all that. But we're also still giving a lot of money to the fossil fuel industry, a lot. It's billions and billions of dollars are going in just subsidies to fossil fuels around the world, right? So while we might be promoting cleaner technologies, these existing policies, existing funding streams are actually propping up some of these industries that are polluting the planet and are making all of us less healthy. So I think the very first thing that we can do is cut those subsidies, right? It doesn't make sense from an economic perspective, and it definitely doesn't make sense from a perspective of public health or the global climate.
Yeah, I would largely echo what Jeff said. You know, there's been a lot of work in environmental politics research in the last 10 years that have shown, like particularly in the United States, the reason we have struggled to pass sweeping climate legislation and address these environmental problems is because of just how much political power polluting industries have. I think Patrick, to be critical of myself 8 years ago, would have heard that statement and just like kind of rolled my eyes a little bit. But I mean, I find the body of evidence to be extraordinarily compelling. So I would echo Jeff in saying that, look, you know, the reason these the reasons these environmental problems persist is in part because our current set of environmental policies, by, you know, providing the financial incentives to the fossil fuel industry that Jeff just described, you know, work to reaffirm the political power of that industry. And here, you know, in this paper, we see a clear consequence of that, right? If we don't have vibrant social movements kind of counterbalancing the political power of industry, then it's difficult for us to think about a future in which, you know, environmental problems like air pollution are addressed for everyone. So what I would kind of shout at policymakers is to, you know, take that seriously in the design of environmental policies and think about the political dimensions of those policies and really how they affect different interest groups' power, in addition to the environmental problems that they set out to address.
And if I can add one sort of last qualification to that set of policy changes, you know, at the same time, there are many communities whose economic livelihoods have depended on the production of fossil fuels for generations. You know, if you think about coal mining communities in Appalachia, or you think about the, communities in Louisiana or Texas, where oil and petrochemicals, have been a really large share of their economy. We can't leave those communities behind either. And so public policy really needs to take into account ways that as we transition away from these more polluting technologies, we can provide new job opportunities for people in these communities. And that involves not only training, but it involves actually keeping folks in these communities financially whole while they shift to a new industry. And it involves also ensuring that new jobs that are created are unionized, so they're going to be well paid, and that they're located in the communities where people live, right? You know, folks are oftentimes told, you know, you need to move to somewhere that has, you know, the jobs in kind of the new growth sectors. And folks say, well, I don't want to move. Like, I'm culturally tied to my community. And so we need to make sure that there are economic alternatives that are as good, if not better, than the jobs that people had in the fossil fuel industry. And that's how we can bring the whole country together around this issue.
Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on In Politic. Your research is absolutely fascinating. It's obviously has enormous implications, not only for American citizens in terms of their health and well-being, but also for the future of America's political system. And you do a wonderful job, I think, raising awareness of what may quickly become a very salient and an important issue, especially for future generations. And I commend you for your efforts. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.